Grade 2 Conference, Lecture 38, Teaching the Saints, Part 10. Clearly, if you indulged me, we could go on all summer long hearing about these saints stories and the wonderful little anecdotes they contain, and to some extent their significance as well. So I'm just going to sort of compress all of this and go very quickly through the remaining saints that I've pointed out as being important and good for the children to hear about. St. Patrick, St. Francis, St. Jerome, let me just deal with them, and St. Bridget as well. All four of these are that group of saints in that category of saints who have a strong connection to the animal world, are able to talk to animals, are able to bring animals into a kind of conversational relationship, though we do not hear of the animals talking back. You'll hear about that actually in grade three. There's one talking animal in the Hebrew scriptures, and if you don't know who that is from Sunday school or Hebrew school, I'll let you find it out, though they don't talk about him much in Hebrew school. But so it's not like the fables. The animals aren't doing the talking, but the animals listen, and by their actions, they show that they clearly understand what is being said to them. So Patrick, he is himself, he comes from a noble Christian family. He's captured by pirates, and they bring him to Ireland, and there for a number of years, he is a shepherd boy who must learn how to train the very fierce and not always cooperative Irish dogs, probably Irish wolfhounds, who themselves look after the sheep, but only when they're trained to do that. And he shows he has incredible capacity for doing this. He's very, very connected with these dogs. And in fact, it really saves his life when he finally is able to get on a ship that allows him to escape from Ireland for a period of time to deepen his Christianity and then return and become the figure who is able to overcome the Druids and convert many of the Irish to Christianity. And with this, the last deed that he does in terms of his battle with the Druids is to banish snakes from Ireland. And there too, he speaks to the snakes and off they go. And Steiner says that the reason that Ireland was able to finally be a place then that was not conducive to the life of snakes was because it is actually one of the last fragments of Atlantis, and that snakes did not have a physical form in Atlantis. So actually, they didn't belong in Ireland anyway, and Patrick was able to do that. I have heard that in recent years, snakes are actually being seen again in Ireland. And some of my Irish friends have connected that with the presence of a lot of American corporations, which have offices and factories and research centers in Ireland, because the labor is relatively cheap and the people are highly educated. So that they said the Americans have brought the snakes back, or the Americans are the snakes. That's we'll have to see how we think about that one. So there's Patrick. The wolfhounds on the one hand and the snakes on the other, showing this strong connection to a kind of Christianized astral body. St. Francis, of course, the grandest of the saints, who has so many wonderful characteristics, very choleric as a youth. We see him as a young man, you know, receiving his astral forces and becoming essentially a high-class gang leader in Italy, pre-mafia, of course, but leading his friends again and again into battles with other groups of teenagers from other city-states that were traditionally rivals, and fighting sometimes to the death, and, you know, not in a nice pageant way, but pretty deadly stuff, until he learns better and then becomes quite the opposite. And we see his forces of tremendous courage and recklessness moving into the religious sphere. That it's not that his character doesn't change, but rather he uses temperament and characterological disposition for very different purposes. And then we see the signs of the taming of Francis's own astral body as he is able to preach to the birds and work with the wolf. And we realize this is Francis's own, you know, not really his own, but a kind of Christian astral body, which is able then to affect these remarkable wonders in the animal world. Bridget also has a connection with a wolf, and she is able to save the life of a poor woodsman who had accidentally killed the wolf, who was a pet of the king, by bringing him a new wolf and showing that the wolf would listen to her. It said that the birds would drop down from the sky at a moment when Bridget called them and wanted to speak to them. And she's also a figure like Francis. Many stories, many adventures, very, very remarkable. And once again, quite a choleric and feisty child, and remains so as an adult as well. Saint Jerome, interesting figure. He is probably a composite of two or even three saints who lived in various places at various times. Among the earliest of the saints, the desert, saints of the desert, the great ascetics, as they were called. But Jerome or Hieronymus or Geronimus, he had, you know, again, different names, perhaps different people. His monastery is often placed in Bethlehem, and we have to remember that the Holy Land is essentially part of Africa, in the great Jordan Rift of Africa. And he was already at this time known to be the greatest scholar of his age. And he was one of that perhaps 0.1% of Christians who could read. And he and his monks were distinguished in their monastery for their great scriptorium, where they were able to take precious lambskin, turn it into vellum, and working with precious inks and precious colors, create the sort of very beginnings of illuminated manuscripts. And Jerome's great life work was translating the books of the Bible, Old and New Testament alike, into the Vulgate, which means the vulgar tongue, the speech of the people, which was Latin. So that translation was entirely due to Jerome and the monks who work with him. So this was a very, very important work. And by the way, this will actually mean something next year as well in grade 3. Among the manuscripts that Jerome was given, the scrolls, which were very similar to the way the Torah is presented in the synagogue today, on those scrolls, there were some extra books which the rabbis of the Israelites did not accept as being divinely inspired, as being divine revelation. And these books were called in Greek the Apocrypha, the sort of extra books. And basically, the Israelites were destroying them because they said they had mistaken notions and they did not really bear the mark of those who inspired Moses and those who inspired the kings. Jerome, however, accepted these books as being divine revelation, and he attached them to what was called the Old Testament, to the Hebrew scriptures, as the books of the Apocrypha. Among the stories in these books are the stories of Tobias and the angel, which was a very popular story in the Renaissance and received many paintings devoted to it. And perhaps more important for us in third grade, the entire story of the Maccabees and their fight against the Hebraic Syrian dictator in Jerusalem, which led to the festival of Hanukkah. Without Jerome having translated what might have been the only remaining book of the Apocrypha, the holiday of Hanukkah, which is not considered to be very important by Orthodox rabbis at all, would probably have essentially disappeared, just been one of the most minor, like Simchat Torah, or even lower down on the list of important festivals for the Jews. But because of Jerome, this very good Catholic monk, we have a very important Jewish holiday. And then there's the lion who walked in to the scriptorium, terrifying the monks who all ran out. But Jerome was too intent on his work and just told the lion to sit quietly while he finished a passage from Holy Scripture. And then he realized that the lion was in pain because of a thorn in his paw. And following that is a wonderful, wonderful story of Jerome and the lion and what the lion does in the monastery. But also we see that though Jerome can speak to an animal, he is not yet as far along as St. Bridget or St. Francis will be later on, that he actually makes a very terrible and nearly tragic mistake concerning this lion. And then we have this wonderful, very compelling story in which he must make good on his error and learns the error of his ways. So it's very beautiful, very wonderful story. And I hope that you were able to bring this to the children. And then I'm just going to skip ahead and talk about one more saint who is not connected with animals, but is one of those saints who's connected with the plant world in a very particular way. And this is Saint Elizabeth. Saint Elizabeth is one of those saints in whom the etheric forces have, we could say, been Christianized. And therefore, we would expect that there'd be perhaps more of a melancholic, phlegmatic quality to her nature. And indeed, there really is. She's like a poster girl for this particular kind of saintliness. She was a noblewoman. She married a very, very powerful and very wealthy nobleman. But when she went into the village that existed and subsisted outside of their castle walls, she saw the kind of suffering that was there, the beggars and the ill. And so she single-handedly organized what we would call today the first soup kitchens, the first programs to bring extra food or leftover food to those who were starving, And she also created what were really the first, we might say, modern types of hospitals, mostly, again, for the poor in her husband's domain. Her husband's Christianity was fairly superficial, and he tolerated what she did, but didn't think very highly of it. And he was a man who loved the simple things in life, you know, hunting and drinking and hunting some more and killing a few people and drinking a little to celebrate, you know, that sort of thing, like man cave stuff. He did, however, get very disturbed because he learned that not only was Elizabeth bringing leftovers to the poor, but she was actually starting to take food right out of the kitchen, you know, hot out of the oven or fresh out of the orchard, and bring that. And he forbade her to do that, you know, absolute prohibition. No, I don't even like the idea that our leftovers are going there. We have, you know, perfectly helpful hunting dogs here who'd love to eat the scraps, and you're wasting them on those people. But she continued to do that. Well, as it happened, her husband went off one day for what was going to be a prolonged hunt with some of his hunting buddies, and left her alone. And she just was so joyful. And once again, with the servants being pledged to silence, she ate very little herself, but the kitchen was kept very busy creating all kinds of wonderful, delectable meals for the poor. And as it happened, one day, the servants who were entrusted with bringing the food to the village left a dozen loaves of bread behind. They forgot to bring that. And Elizabeth said, you know, that bread will not be as good tomorrow. I want the people to eat it. I want them to know what fresh bread really tastes like. I'll bring it myself. It was a chilly day, so she was wearing a voluminous cloak, and she wrapped the bread under her cloak to keep it as warm as possible and began to rapidly make her way on foot into the village. And then she saw clouds of dust arising in the near distance, and she knew what that meant. Men on horseback were approaching, her husband and his fellow hunters. And before she could find her way into the walls of the town, they were upon her. Her husband saw her. And there she was with her arms wrapped around herself, keeping that bread warm, but also keeping it hidden. And from his horse, he looked at her and he said, "Well, where is your greeting, my dear wife?" And she said, "Well, I'm very, very cold. I will, you know, embrace you when we are back in the castle." And he looked at one of his friends and said, "Do you see how her cloak bulges? I suspect she is bringing some of our food. Food that's meant for our dinner tonight. She's bringing that to those peasants, those scallywags. Well, what do you have there?" And Elizabeth did not know what to say. And she struggled and she battled with herself, and she could not do it. She could not acknowledge that she had disobeyed her husband and taken food from her own kitchen and his kitchen to feed the poor. Oh, she said, roses, I'm bringing roses to the poor." And he laughed. He said, "In the middle of winter, I see. Very interesting. Well, why don't you open your cloak? Because my friends and I would love to see the roses that you have." and tears welled up in her eyes. She turned pale. She began to shake, but she pulled open her cloak, and there they were, a dozen fresh, beautiful roses. Her husband looked not terribly happy and rode off with his friends to the palace. She had spoken truthfully. What could he say? And she brought the roses then to the hospital, where people looked at them in absolute wonder. Roses in the middle of winter. So, an interesting story, is it not? She lied. She actually told a lie. A saint who lied. Now, here we see something that I brought out in those two more esoteric lectures. Just because you carry one body of the Jesus being does not mean that you carry the others as well. And that one body can be very lofty and very pure and infallible in a certain way, and your other three bodies can just go their own way. So the etheric body is incapable of dishonesty. If we were all etheric beings, we would not lie. We wouldn't know how to lie. The theme of the etheric body is belief. I believe in everything. Everything is true. That's why we don't want children to see movies when they're very young, because the etheric body will believe everything it sees. However, Elizabeth's astral body was still imperfect, was still like our astral bodies, and was capable, under pressure, under duress, of uttering a lie. And then in a certain way, the healing forces of the etheric body, the divine quality of the etheric body, forgives and transforms, so that what she spoke as a lie out of her astral body, the etheric body heals and makes a truth. We don't say any of that to the children, but I can assure you, this story makes a powerful impact, because there are children in the class who are perhaps on the verge of starting to tell lies for the first time in their life, and there certainly will be children in third grade who begin to do this. So this is a powerful story, wonderful woman saint, so beloved that she's actually the saint. She's Saint Elizabeth of Hungary and Saint Elizabeth of Thuringia. There are many places that claim her for their own. And those of our Canadian friends, next time you're in Toronto, there is a church of St. Elizabeth. I think it's a Hungarian church with an incredible sculpture on its front of her opening her cloak and revealing the roses. It's high-powered stuff. Really, really beautiful and really huge. So if you have a chance, take a look at that. So with this kind of ambivalent picture, just to show, the saints are not goody-two-shoes at all. They're very deep and very lofty stories, but they carry within them the full breadth of humanity. I will end our discussion of the saints, and we will go on to look further afield in grade 2.